Lecture 10, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Hersham, October 4th, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. Last time, what we considered was spherically symmetric potentials. We showed that independent of the details of the spherically symmetric potential, as long as it was spherically symmetric, we could use separation of variables to create an angular equation, which we solved. Angular equation was independent of the potential, and so that solution is always the same. So we're just going to refer back to it once we've decided what values of L and M are relevant for a given physical situation. We also developed an equation for R, the so-called radial equation, and we expressed it in terms of some new term U. The equation for U looked very similar to the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, with the exception that there's this additional centrifugal term, which will tend to repel the particle away from the origin of the coordinate system. Today what we're going to do is consider a specific potential. If you recall, last time we did the simplest possible spherically symmetric potential, which was the infinite spherical well. Today we're going to consider one which is much more challenging to solve mathematically, but very important for essentially all of the periodic table, and therefore of great fundamental importance to material science. And that problem which we will be considering is that of the hydrogen atom. The hydrogen atom, of course, has one proton and one electron. The proton is much more massive than the electron, so effectively it stays stationary while the electron is moving, if you want to think about it classically, about that fixed nucleus. We'll choose the nucleus as the origin of our coordinate system, and the potential between the electron and the proton will be the Coulomb potential. The Coulomb potential is only a function of the distance between the two. Since we've chosen the proton as the origin, R represents the position of the electron. The Coulomb potential is negative E squared because the charge of the nucleus is positive fundamental unit of charge, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. The electron is negative 1 fundamental unit of charge, and so this will be negative E squared, where E represents the fundamental unit of charge, divided by 4 pi epsilon naught times 1 over R. And so this is a 1 over R potential. To solve this potential, we have to only solve the radial equation. So there's only one equation we have to solve. Of course, we'll employ the solution to the angular equation once we've determined this solution. They have to be multiplied together to give us the full wave function. The radial equation in this case is negative h bar squared over 2m, second derivative of u with respect to r, plus the spherically symmetric potential, which is negative e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, 1 over r, plus the centrifugal term, which is h bar squared over 2m, l plus 1 over r squared, operating on u, is equal to eu. Now, it's convention to try to relate this back to the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, and to do that, you could define some new potential and effective potential. And that effective potential, if we define it in this way, would then reduce down to the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation. So for the hydrogen atom, let's see what the effective potential looks like. So if we were to plot the effective potential as a function of R, of course it would vary as a function of L. L is a measure now of the centrifugal term. When L is 0, that term does not exist, and all we have is the Coulomb potential. And of course, the Coulomb potential looks something like this. Okay. It's an attractive potential. It's going to tend to pull the electron towards the proton, or the nucleus. If we increase L to a larger value, L equal 1 is the next possibility, this is going to tend to push the electron away from the nucleus. It represents a repulsive term. And as a result, when L equals 1, you'll get a potential which looks something like this. Okay. Importantly, you can see that this potential is going to be very repulsive as we go close to the origin. And as a result, we expect the electron to be farther away if L is equal to 1. If L equals 2, this just gets pushed out further. This is obviously a qualitative plot that I'm making here. The quantitative plot is in the textbook, or I printed out in the lecture notes for any of you who want to see it. But I think you can see qualitatively that this is what we'd expect. As L increases, the potential will become more repulsive, and as a result, there would be a centrifugal force, if you will, forcing the electron farther away. So qualitatively, that's what we're going to expect to see. That for the ground state, where L equals 0, the electron will be closest to the nucleus. Everybody okay with the qualitative picture? Okay. So what we're going to attempt to do is solve this equation today. If you recall when we did the harmonic oscillator potential in 1D, I presented you with two possible solutions. One was the algebraic method using raising and lowering operators, which is what we did in class. But I also said there's an exact or brute force way of solving that equation, which was a power series approach. And I said at the time that we would skip it because we'd come back to it here. So we're eventually going to get this into the power series form. It's kind of detailed, but there are some important points in it which I really want to highlight, and I think it's worth doing at least once. So what we're going to seek are the bound states. Now, I should point out that this potential also will have scattering states, so you could seek scattering state solutions as well if you wanted to do that. If you look in Griffiths, he saves scattering solutions all the way till chapter 10 or 11, so we're not going to cover it in this course. But I think you guys have the necessary understanding to read ahead if you were so inclined to care about the scattering states. We'll only care about the bound states when the energy is less than 0. And so the first thing we're going to do is try to rewrite this equation in a form which is easier to manipulate. And like we did before, we're going to let kappa equal square root negative 2me over h bar. Because energy is less than 0, this will be a positive real number for kappa. I should also point out that this implies that the energy is equal to negative h bar squared kappa squared over 2m, as we've seen before. With this new definition, we can now go ahead and plug it in to the equation and come up with the form of the radial equation, which will be 1 over kappa squared, second derivative u with respect to r squared, plus e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, 2m over h bar squared kappa squared times 1 over r, minus 1 over kappa squared r squared times the quantity L plus 1. That operates on u and will be equal to u. If you can see what happened here, I divided both sides by e and then utilized this form, energy is equal to negative h bar squared kappa squared over 2m, and plugged it in. And there's going to be a 1 over e term, which will go as 1 over kappa squared for each of these three terms on the left-hand side of the equation. Okay, so all I've done is divided by e and substituted in this new term, kappa. Kappa, as you may have noticed from previous potentials or uses of this term, has the units of 1 over length. And as a result, if you look here, for example, this term here, you'll see a kappa squared and a second derivative with respect to r. And so this will have the effect of a unitless parameter, which I'm now going to define. I'm going to define this unitless parameter rho, which is kappa times r. So it's a dimensionless variable. I'm going to go ahead and make that substitution into this differential equation. And as a result, this term here will simply become second derivative of u with respect to rho. So we have a kappa squared term and an r squared term in the denominator, plus e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught 2m h bar squared kappa times 1 over rho okay, where you can see that one of the kappas and the R have been substituted with rho. This term here is kappa squared R squared, so that will now become 1 over rho squared. So the third term becomes L plus 1 over rho squared. That operates on U and is equal to U. One more thing that I'll point out is that this term here, in front of 1 over rho, is of course a function of kappa and some constants. Kappa is a function of energy. This is a very complicated term here, so just for bookkeeping purposes, I'm going to now define a new parameter, rho naught. Rho naught, you can see, is a function of kappa, which is a function of energy. So if we find later that rho naught is quantized, or we find some constraints on rho naught due to the boundary conditions, that will imply constraint on kappa and therefore constraint on energy. But rather than carrying these constants through for the next half hour, I'm just going to define it as rho naught. And as a result, with these definitions of kappa and rho naught, we can now write the radial equation in the following form. Second derivative of u with respect to rho is equal to, now moving the other two terms to the right-hand side of the equation, we'll get the quantity 1 minus rho naught over rho plus L times L plus 1 over rho squared operating on U. And so we've reduced the Coulomb potential radial equation to this differential equation here. So at least cosmetically it looks simpler. It's not obvious, though, in all likelihood to you, what the solution to this equation is. And so what we're going to do is consider limiting cases to begin with. So what we want to consider is the asymptotic behavior of U. So for example, if we let rho go to infinity, then you can see that this term here goes as 1 over rho squared, and this term here, which goes as 1 over rho, will go to 0 much more quickly than 1, of course, which is a constant. And as a result, this differential equation in the limit of rho going to infinity is simply equal to second derivative of u with respect to rho is equal to u. And we know this differential equation. It's going to have the form u in the limit of rho going to infinity should have the form some constant a times e to the negative rho plus b times e to the rho. Okay. However, we know that this equation is valid in the limit of rho going to infinity, and as a result, this term here blows up, and so we can see that b has to equal 0. So the second term blows up as rho goes to infinity, and as a result, b has to equal 0. And so in the limit as rho goes to infinity, we expect u to have the form of some constant a times e to the negative rho. So it should exponentially decay. Okay, this is not terribly surprising. Almost all wave functions we've considered tend to exponentially decay in the limit of large distance. And rho is just a new form of distance with some constant kappa out in front. The second limiting case we want to consider is rho going to 0. If we look at this equation in the limit of rho going to 0, then this term is going to become much larger than either of these two terms. And as a result, we can write the radial equation simply as the second derivative of u with respect to rho is equal to L plus 1 over rho squared times u. This differential equation is relatively famous. It has the following solution. U will now be approximately equal to some constant c times rho to the L plus 1 plus a d times rho to the negative L. If it's not obvious to you, go ahead and take the second derivative and plug this into this differential equation, and you'll find that these are the two linearly independent solutions. What I want to point out, though, is that the second term in this form of the solution blows up as rho goes to 0. This is going as rho to the negative L. And of course, this equation is only valid in the limit of rho going to 0. And as a result, we would conclude that the term D must equal 0. And so as rho goes to 0, we'd expect U to have the form some constant C times rho to the L plus 1 power. Is everybody comfortable with these two limiting cases? Of course, what we're seeking is a solution which is true for all values of rho. And so what this limiting behavior motivates, so this motivates the choice of a new function, nu, which will be a function of rho, which is going to connect together the two limiting cases. So we're going to say that u will have the form of one limiting case, rho to the L plus first power, times the second limiting case, e to the negative rho, times some function nu, which will connect the two solutions together. Now, I want to point out that we could have done this from the start, but we've just considered the limiting cases to make some guess as to what the new form of this equation should be. Okay, so we're not doing anything here which is not general. U is some unknown function, and it's still an unknown function. It's just some two functions which are known multiplied by an unknown function nu. This discussion of the asymptotic behavior is just motivating why we would choose such a function. So what we have to do is now plug this new form into the radial equation and try to move forward and find nu. Because once we know nu, then we know u. And once we know u, then we know the whole wave function, because we just have to find the angular solutions, which we already calculated last time. So to do this, to plug this equation into here, we have to take two derivatives of u. And this is a mess because we have three terms here. So we have to apply the product rule three times for each of the derivatives. So you can imagine there's going to be a bunch of terms which come out of this. I'm just going to write down the result of each derivative. If you want to check it, feel free to go ahead and execute this product rule a few times. But the first derivative of u with respect to rho goes as rho to the Lth power times e to the negative rho times the quantity L plus 1 minus rho times nu plus rho d nu d rho. And while I'm erasing, you can sort of eyeball the form of u, and you might be able to see how this derivative would be calculated and make sense. What we then have to do is take the second derivative, so we have to take the derivative of that term there, and then plug it back into the radial equation. And so it's not particularly pleasant, because now we have a number of terms already, each of which have three terms which are a function of rho, so you have to apply this product rule multiple times here. But if you go ahead and do that, take the second derivative of u with respect to rho in terms of this new function nu, what you get is the following. Rho to the Lth power, e to the negative rho, times the quantity, negative 2L minus 2 plus rho plus L times L plus 1 over rho times nu plus 2 times the quantity L plus 1 minus rho d nu d rho plus rho times the second derivative of nu with respect to rho. Okay, so now at this point you may be asking yourself, what on earth am I doing? Am I really making this any simpler? Is it any simpler to express the radial equation in this form? The good news is that many of these terms cancel. So if you go ahead and plug this in to the radial equation, and you look at the terms and you cancel out those which are like on each side of the equation, then we can express in terms of nu the radial equation becomes rho times the second derivative of nu with respect to rho plus 2 times the quantity L plus 1 minus rho d nu d rho plus rho naught minus 2 L plus 1 times nu is equal to 0. Okay. So it's up to you whether or not you think this is easier or not than the original radial equation. But it's now in a form which is going to be very suitable for taking a power series approach towards solving it. And that's ultimately where we were trying to get to today. So I don't want you to get too caught up in the details. All that we've done is looked at the limiting case of the radial equation, found the form of the limiting cases, and then defined a new function nu which connects the limiting cases together, and then simply done math to get to this point, which is just derivatives and algebra. The real question is, how do we solve this differential equation? So once we have this, then we know u, and then we know the wave function. So how we're going to attempt to solve this differential equation is to seek a power series solution. And the idea here is that any function can be expressed as a power series. And as a result, we're going to express nu as a power series. And if we can find the coefficients in the power series, then we know nu, and we know everything. So the general form of a power series form of any function is a sum from j equals 0 to infinity of some coefficient c sub j times rho sub j. So once we know the c sub j's, then we know nu, then we know u, and then we know the wave function. So we're going to try to reduce this down into a problem where we try to find c sub j. To do this, of course, we have to plug this form into this equation, and it's going to require first derivative and a second derivative of the power series. So that's the next step. We want to first take the derivative of nu with respect to rho in terms of the power series form. This will be equal to the sum from j equals 0 to infinity of j c sub j rho to the j minus 1 power, because the derivative of rho to the j is just j rho to the j minus 1. What I want to point out here, though, is that this form of the solution, j is equal to 0, so the first term goes to 0. And so it's equivalent to define this in terms of a new index that is offset the index by 1. And this form of the solution is equivalent to the sum from j equals 0 to infinity of j plus 1 c to the j plus 1 times rho sub j. So all I've done is inserted j plus 1 for j, and we're allowed to do that because the first term in this power series goes to 0. So if this is not clear, go ahead and write out the first few terms of this power series and that power series, and you'll see that these are equivalent formulations. Is everybody okay with this? All right. If you've worked with power series before, you've probably seen this trick many times. We now have to take the second derivative. So the second derivative will be equal to a sum from j equals 0 to infinity of j times j plus 1 times c sub j plus 1 rho to the j minus 1 power. Again, we just employed the fact that the derivative of rho to the j is j rho to the j minus 1. At this point, if we wanted to, we could again redefine a new index and offset all of these again because the first term here cancels. We'll find that in the solution, it's convenient to keep it in this form. Now what we have to do is plug in these three terms into the new form of the radial equation and look at the result. So we will do that. So what we're going to get plugging in these three power series into the radial equation is that we're going to get the following equation. A sum from j equals 0 to infinity of j times j plus 1 c sub j plus 1 rho to the j, because the first term is just rho times the second derivative of nu with respect to rho. which would be this term here times rho. So rho times j minus 1 is just rho to the jth power. Plus 2 times l plus 1 sum from j equals 0 to infinity of j plus 1 c sub j plus 1 rho to the j minus 2 times the sum j equals 0 to infinity of j c sub j rho to the j plus the quantity rho naught minus 2 l plus 1 times the sum from j equals 0 to infinity of c sub j rho to the j. And that equals 0. So all we've done is plugged in these three power series into the radial equation. Okay, now again, you're probably asking yourself, what on earth am I doing? Are we really making any progress here? This looks complicated. But what we've done is now expressed all terms of this equation in terms of rho to the jth power. Okay. So the only way for this equation to be 0 for all values of rho is if the terms out in front of each term in the power series goes to 0. I mean, obviously, one solution is rho equal to 0, but that is, of course, a non-physical solution. So the only other solution is when the coefficients in front of each term in the power series goes to 0. So what we've done is reduced this problem from a differential equation problem into an algebraic problem. That's, of course, nice because algebra is easier to do than differential equations. One thing you'll notice in that equation I just wrote down is that some of the terms in front of rho sub j are c sub j terms, and some of the terms are c sub j plus 1 terms. And as a result, if we set all the coefficients equal to 0, we can put the c sub j plus 1 terms on one side, the c sub j terms on the other side, and what this will result in is a recursion relation for all c sub j's. Question?
I'm just wondering, are there, like, I know that for this problem, it's okay to seek a power series solution, but are there situations where that won't be a great idea?
You can always go for it. Whether or not it's easier then another approach is an important question. In this case, we're going to see that it's going to lead to some constraints on the values of c sub j. And those constraints are going to be quite fundamental. We'll see that in a minute. But for any solution, for any differential equation, you could go this route. But the resulting math that you'll go through may be much more laborious than another approach. So it's always an option. It's not always the best option. In this case, it will ultimately lead to some constraints on the principal quantum number, and that's what we're after. Okay, so for this equation to be true for all values of rho, the only solution which is physical is if the coefficients vanish for each j. In other words, the first term, j plus 1. Now I'm grouping together all the c sub j plus 1 terms. So we see that also includes the quantity 2 l plus 1 times j plus 1 times c sub j plus 1. Plus, and I'm going to group together the c sub j terms, which are the second line in that equation, the quantity negative 2j plus rho naught minus 2 l plus 1 times c sub j equals 0. That is, the coefficient in front of each rho sub j has to go to 0. So you've reduced this differential equation to an algebraic equation. And in particular, we could move the c sub j term to the right-hand side and divide through by this term in front of the c sub j plus 1 and determine a recursion relation. So this implies that c sub j plus 1 is equal to 2 times the quantity j plus l plus 1 minus rho naught over j plus 1 times the quantity j plus 2L plus 2 times C sub j. And so the power series solution implies a recursion relation for C sub j. Remember, what a recursion relation does is if you know the first term in the series, so C naught, you can calculate any later value, C1, C2, C3, etc., using the recursion relation. C naught will, of course, be a constant and will ultimately become a normalization constant. So this is working out beautifully for us because we know that there's always one last trick up our sleeve, and that is normalization to get the last constant. So we've reduced this problem from trying to find an infinite number of constants to finding one constant. Now, this recursion relation looks nice, but there's a catch. So let's think about it a little bit harder. Like anything we do in this class, we go through the math, and once we've done the math, we need to think about the result physically and see if it makes sense. So does this result make sense physically? So let's try to analyze it. In particular, what I'm going to do is consider limiting behavior. And that's what I recommend you always do when you derive an equation, is considering the limiting cases, see if those make sense. If they don't, then you know the result has some flaw to it. So let's consider the limiting case of large j. So for large j, you can see that rho naught is some value, a function of energy. L and 1 are finite values. And so for large j, the only thing which survives in the numerator will be 2 times j. So for large j, C sub j plus 1 will be approximately equal to 2j in the numerator. In the denominator, j will be much larger than L and 2, and so this j will survive. And in principle, you could write the denominator as j squared, because j is obviously larger than 1. But for convenience, we're going to keep the plus 1 here. So this will be equal to j times j plus 1. This is certainly true. We could possibly simplify further by going to j squared here, but it's going to be convenient to keep the 1. Of course, the j's cancel, and so this is just equal, this is multiplied by c sub j, of course. And this will be equal now to 2 over j plus 1 times c sub j. So this is true in the limit of large j. So let's assume that this result is true, in which case this would be true. So we're going to assume this is the exact result. And it would be approximately exact in the limit of large j. Okay. This implies that if we use the recursion relation and we knew C sub 0, that C sub j plus 1 would be equal to 2 times j plus 1 times 2 over j times 2 over j minus 1 all the way down to C naught. Right, because that's what the recursion relation does. You're going to get a value of 2 over j minus 1, 2 over j, 2 over j plus 1, etc. And the number of terms here will, of course, be equal to j plus 1 factors. So we have to apply the recursion relation j plus 1 times to get from 0 to j plus 1. And as a result, what you're going to get is 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, j plus 1 times, which is equal to 2 to the j plus 1. In the denominator, you're going to get j plus 1, j, j minus 1, etc., down to 1, which is just equal to j plus 1 factorial times c naught. Okay? So all we're doing is saying that, let's say this is true, in the limit of large j, we can now express c sub j plus 1 in terms of this simple equation here. Now you can see why I kept the j plus 1, because now we can take advantage of this similar term in the numerator. Okay. Of course, if this is true for c of j plus 1, the value for c sub j will just be equal to 2 to the j over j factorial times c naught. Okay, so all I've done is replaced the j plus 1 with j. This implies that nu, remember nu is just a power series in terms of C sub j, So nu will be equal to C naught times the sum from j equals 0 to infinity of C sub j, which we now see as 2 to the j over j factorial, times rho sub j. Now, this power series may look familiar to you. The power series for e to the x is equal to x to the j over j factorial. And as a result, 2 times rho to the jth power is representing x. And as a result, this equals c naught times e to the 2 rho-th power. Okay? So you have to go back to your calculus days and remember power series expressions for e to the x. And it's just equal to x to the j over j factorial. Okay, so what? Well, if that's true, this implies that u, which if you recall we expressed in terms of nu, it was equal to rho to the l plus 1 times e to the negative rho times nu. But now we know nu, and this limit should go as e to the 2 rho. And as a result, this will be equal to c naught times rho to the l plus 1. E to the 2 rho times e to the negative rho is just e to the rho. But this, of course, blows up as rho goes to infinity. And so what we've deduced is that this exact solution from this equation implies a non-physical result, because the wave function no longer can be normalized. And so the question is, where did we go wrong? I mean, what is wrong with our logic here? And nothing is wrong with our logic. What this tells us is that this equation will not be true in the limit of large j. And the only way for that to occur is if one of the j's, say C sub j max, if we plugged it into this equation, would give us 0. Then C sub j max plus 1 would be 0, C sub j max plus 2 would be 0, etc. So there would be no large terms in this recursion relation. What it tells you is that the power series must terminate. The only way we can get a normalizable solution to this differential equation is if the power series terminates. So everybody accept that reasoning. So what we conclude from this analysis, employing or utilizing the physics of the situation, is that the power series must terminate. And this is the critical point. It is this termination, which is implied by the fact that a wave function has to be normalizable. This is the reason why there are quantized energy levels in the hydrogen atom. This is the big moment. So if you accept this, then you'll see basically everything there is to know about the hydrogen atom. This implies, as I was saying, that C sub j max plus 1 has to equal 0. Because once we have that, then all larger values of j, or any larger value of C sub j, will also be 0. And there will be no more terms in the power series. And as a result, we'll not have to worry about this limiting case of large j, because there will be no large j terms that survive. In the limit of small j, we'll find that the wave function is perfectly normalizable and therefore a physical solution. So if you look at this conclusion here, and we go back to our recursion relation, what you can see is that when j equals j max, the numerator of the recursion relation has to go to 0. And in that way, C sub j max plus 1 would equal 0. What that implies is that rho naught, if you just look at it, is going to be equal to 2 times j plus l plus 1. J, we know, is some number between, it's a whole number between 0 and infinity. L, we know, also is a whole number between 0 and infinity from the solution of the angular equation. And as a result, there's going to be a limit or a quantization of rho naught. Quantization of rho naught implies quantization of kappa, which implies quantization of energy. So to reiterate, in order to have this final constraint be true, from the recursion relation, we see that the only way for C sub j max plus 1 to be equal to 0 is if 2, that is the numerator, times J max plus L plus 1 minus rho naught equals 0. Now, as I've said, J max can be a value 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. L can be a value 0, 1, 2, etc. And so it's customary to define a new term n, which is equal to J max plus L plus 1. And this will be known as the principal quantum number, which you have learned about in chemistry. Since, as I've just said, J max can equal 0, 1, 2, etc. And we know from the angular equation that L is 0, 1, 2, etc. This implies that N, the principal quantum number, can only have the values 1, 2, 3, etc. So the fact that the power series must terminate implies quantization of N, the principal quantum number. But if you look at this equation, we see that 2 times N minus rho naught equals 0. So that implies that rho naught has to equal 2N. But rho naught, if you recall, I defined before, was E squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, 2M over H bar squared kappa squared. Furthermore, kappa is square root negative 2ME over H bar. And so quantization of rho naught implies quantization of kappa, which implies quantization of energy. And as a result, the only allowed energies in the hydrogen atom will be equal to negative E squared over 4 pi epsilon naught quantity squared times M over 2 H bar squared 1 over N squared. Everything out in front of the 1 over N squared term are fundamental constants of nature. So we can express this in terms of some new term E sub 1, which is of course the result of this equation when N equals 1, divided by N squared, where E1, if you plug in the fundamental units of nature, is negative 13.6 electron volts. And this is the very famous Bohr formula. If you know something about the history of physics, you'll know that Bohr deduced this formula before the advent of quantum mechanics, and he used some very sketchy pseudo-classical theory to do it. Of course, everybody knew what the answer was supposed to be, because this was measured. And so you could figure out ways of rationalizing this result. But this was really one of the great feats of quantum mechanics, was coming up with a logical, reasonable deduction of the Bohr formula from the Schrodinger equation. Another thing that I'll point out is that because rho naught equals 2 times n, we can express the recursion relation in terms of n. And as a result, C sub J plus 1 will be equal to 2 times J plus L plus 1 minus N over J plus 1 J plus 2 L plus 2 times C sub J. And so the principal quantum number shows up in the recursion itself, recursion relation itself, and we can utilize that in forming excited state wave functions of the hydrogen atom. Other things I'd like to point out is that since N equals J max plus L plus 1, the maximum value of L is restricted for a given N. Okay, so we've shown from the radial equation that there are constraints on N. Furthermore, the radial equation will imply that the constraints on N will imply constraints on L. In particular, if n equals 1, the only way for n to equal 1 is if j max equals 0 and l equals 0. So if n equals 1, that implies j max has to equal 0, and therefore l has to equal 0. On the other hand, if n equals 2, you can imagine two possibilities. One possibility is that j max equals 0. If j max equals 0, then l would have to equal 1. Or j max could equal 1, which would imply l equals 0. And as a result, we will see that the value of l will always be less than or equal to n minus 1. This is a very fundamental relationship, which is, again, often introduced in chemistry without justification. And now we see that it's a direct consequence of the Schrodinger equation. I'd also like to remind you that m, from the angular equation, has constraints on it. M will equal negative l plus 1, to 0, to l minus 1, to l. That is, if l equals 2, m is negative 2, negative 1, 0, 1, 2. And so the constraints on n imply constraints on l, which imply constraints on m. And of course, these constraints on m come out of the angular equation, which of course is also valid in this case. So like we've seen many times now in this course, the Schrodinger equation will imply some general solution, and the boundary conditions will imply quantization. And we now have three quantum numbers which will define the hydrogen atom. Those of you who have taken chemistry before know that there's a fourth quantum number affiliated with spin. The Schrodinger equation doesn't deal with spin. That's a severe limitation of the Schrodinger equations. We'll talk about spin next time. But in summary, the Coulomb potential implies many things. First of all, we know, because it's spherically symmetric, that capital R, the radial portion of the wave function, is equal to U over lowercase r, that we derived last time. U of rho is rho to the l plus 1 e to the negative rho times nu, where rho is kappa times r. Nu, we know, is a power series from j equals 0 to infinity, c sub j, rho sub j. But this will terminate at some value j max, which is dictated by n. N is equal to j max plus l plus 1, where c sub j max plus 1 equals 0. Kappa, we know, is square root negative 2me over h bar, which we now know is equal to e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught m over h bar squared over n. Because of the Bohr formula, we know how E is related to N. You'll notice here, or I told you before, that kappa has units of 1 over distance. And so all the terms out in front of the 1 over N should have units of 1 over distance. And so it's typical and customary to now express this in the terms of 1 over A times N, where A obviously is equal to this term here, or 1 over A is equal to that term. So A is equal to 4 pi epsilon naught h bar squared over m e squared. A will have units of distance, and this is a famous distance known as the Bohr radius. And it's just equal to fundamental units of nature, and so it's a constant equal to 0.529 angstroms. It tells us that the size of an atom must be on the length scale of angstroms. There's other things we should note about these solutions. First of all, is that for a particular value of n, there's a unique value of energy. But for a particular value of n, there can be multiple values of l and m. And as a result, each of the values of n will imply a degeneracy of levels. The degeneracy in the hydrogen atom, which I'm going to call d, and of course will be a function of the principal quantum number n, will be equal to a sum from L equals 0 to n minus 1. So we know L runs from 0 up to n minus 1. But each value of L has 2L plus 1 values of m. And so we're going to have to sum over the quantity 2L plus 1. These sums are presumably known or could be looked up if you haven't seen them before. And it has the form of 2 times 1 half n, n minus 1. That's the first term here. The sum from 0 to n minus 1 of L is 1 half n times n minus 1. Sum from L equals 0 to n minus 1 of 1, of course, is just equal to n. So this will be plus n. This will therefore be equal to 2 times 1 half, which is 1, n squared minus n plus n. And so the degeneracy will be n squared. And so when n equals 1, there's singular degeneracy. When n equals 2, we'll have fourfold degeneracy, etc. Now, this should seem a little off to you, because if you look at the periodic table, the first row has 2, but then the second row has 8, not 1 and 4. And so there has to be another factor of 2 somewhere, and that factor of 2 will come from spin. And so we can see the degeneracy of the hydrogen atom manifests itself in the periodic table, first row having 2, second row having 8, etc. One thing which should immediately jump out at you is, why doesn't the third row have 18? And we'll talk about that next time. All right, thanks.
MSE 405.